From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Jim Whittaker first saw the wreckage of the Twin Towers about a month after 9/11, a realization came to him almost right away that this place was going to change, wasn't always going to stay a smoldering pile, that one day it would look different. And he says that gave him hope. But it also gave him a sense of urgency that he had to record that change, to film it. So at first, his project was about time-lapse photography, various cameras at various angles capturing the changes at Ground Zero, frame by frame. But soon the project evolved into a larger film, a kind of human time-lapse, five people directly affected by 9/11 who are struggling to remember those they lost and yet move on with their lives at the same time. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentaries. Jim Whittaker is joining us to talk about his film. It's called Rebirth, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jim Whittaker's film Rebirth premiered at Sundance this year. It tracks the lives of five people over the course of the nearly 10 years since the attacks on 9/11. These were people who lost a mother, a friend, a fiancé, a brother. And everything about the film is about change and progression. It features some remarkable time-lapse photography of the Ground Zero site, and we see the people themselves affected, physically changing while they try and heal. There's a moment when a construction worker, Brian, who lost his brother and has helped oversee the 9/11 project, says finally he sees part of the project where the tearing down part has ended. And they had gotten to the point where they were building things. Out of the ground she comes, Brian says. And in some ways, that's what Jim Whittaker's film is really about. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on documentaries. Jim Whittaker is joining us to talk about his film. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jim Whittaker is chairman and producer of Whittaker Entertainment at Walt Disney Studios. He directed and produced Rebirth. He's also the founder of Project Rebirth, which includes projects like a film library, multimedia tools to help those affected by 9/11, and a forthcoming media installation at the September 11th Memorial and Museum. We should say that this Thursday night, KUER and the SLC Film Center is presenting a free screening of Rebirth, and we'll give you details about that as we go along. Jim Whittaker is joining us today from a studio in Los Angeles, California. And Jim Whittaker, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Doug. I appreciate you having me.
I wanted to begin, if we could, with your own reaction to the attacks on 9/11, which was about a month after. You went to Ground Zero with your wife, I think it was. And I wanted you to just give us a sense of what it was like when you went there, what you saw, what you experienced.
Well, I would start with the night before, actually, if I may. I was actually at a friend's wedding, a guy named Nick Wood I went to college with, and he had called me, actually, a few weeks before and said, you know, Jim, I'm going to get married, but it's kind of an awkward thing, and what do you think? And I said, you know, you got to move forward. And so there I was at the wedding, and it was a beautiful affair, and I remember just kind of watching it take place, and I sort of looked over into the corner. In the corner, there was a group of guys from Wall Street. He works on Wall Street, and they were all over there crying. And I remember just seeing them there, and I thought of this sort of dichotomy of this this joy and this grief. And I went to bed that night, and I woke up the next morning, and I said to my wife, Chris, I said, you know, I want to go to Ground Zero. And I said, look, if you know, one day if we have children, I want to just be able to tell them what it was like. And so we went down, and you know, it was a month after, so you could smell the gasoline that people often talk about. You could see and feel, you could see the debris, and the pile was still there, and you could feel the anxiety and the dread. And it was certainly, I felt it as I was looking around. And you know, what happened to me is I was looking at the pile, and I remember very distinctly watching one particular woman who had a mask on. Many people had masks on, and she was deliberately walking around the site. And I kind of looked at her, and I saw her face, and she just wasn't really paying attention to the pile. It's not that she, of course it was there, but she had this determined look on her face. And I thought, wow, she's just moving on. And it forced me to kind of look at the pile and the debris, and I thought, you know, one day this won't be here. And I thought, wow, what would that be like when it's not there? And for a moment, I thought in the imagination of it not being there, I felt this sense of this kind of upswell of hope. And it made me think, wow, how in a very short period of time, I'd been there about 20 minutes at the time, could I go from feeling this dread and anxiety at such a deep level to this place of feeling an upswell of hope? I thought, wow, wouldn't that be incredible if you could have people experience that? And so that literally was kind of the blessing of the moment, was a moment where I thought, oh, wow, if I could just record this and allow it to be whatever it's going to be over time, and then take whatever it is over whatever amount of time that this changes and condense it to 20 minutes, is my original thought, then I suppose the feeling would be just what I had, which is this feeling of dread and anxiety, this place of hope. And that was really the idea. And so I just said, well, let's, you know, the way to do that is time lapse. It's put the cameras up and just start recording.
So it wasn't even then, it wasn't people telling stories. It was just this image of this thing changing, moving.
100%. I was struck by also the feeling that there were people down there working.
Yeah.
And I sort of knew that the work that was taking place, the physicality of it, was going to take the debris away. And then, of course, the physicality of it was going to build the buildings. And I thought, you know, buildings, you know, they don't get built by cranes. They get built by people, obviously, who are in the middle of that. And I thought there's something so strong and, to me, was felt so powerful about the idea, no matter what was there, was that just the act of something else being there, no matter what, was something that felt to me that had an emotional power to it. And I actually, early in my career, I worked at for a small documentary film company out of college called Hillman and Carr, and they made films for museums. And I actually had the first thought was, wouldn't it be great to actually put these cameras up and then surround an audience with these images and allow the buildings to literally arise around an audience so they could feel it from all directions.
Wow.
So the original idea, it didn't actually have to do with people, as you said. It actually just had to do with the feeling of putting people in a space and a place where the feeling of the buildings, the sounds of the site, which I began to record from the very beginning because I felt the evolution of the sound of the site would be important as well. And then I began saying, well, kind of what about the people as I was there? And I was so, you know, the grief was so heavy, the loss was so heavy, and my interactions with folks, it was so intense. And that gave me the second part of the idea, which was to, you know, find initially 10 people who had been affected by the day and begin to follow their lives in a human time-lapse-like fashion. Interviewing them once a year, every year, to see how their lives would evolve over time.
Well, it's important to say, I think, Jim Whitaker, that so yes, the human dimension of the film is important, but the time lapse part doesn't just fade into the background, and it's not just cover. I mean, this isn't B-roll. I mean, it's like this time lapse imagery is like a character in the film itself. Do you think?
Well, I do. I mean, what began to emerge was, and what I kind of felt from the beginning, no matter what happened, I felt like there was a certain meditation of the time lapse that existed. I mean, there's many qualities to it. It's not just the building that's taking place, but when the building wasn't taking place, it was the change of seasons that were taking place. And
can I mention one of those
time
moments?
Time was passing.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, I mean, because there's this shot taken from the Trinity Church across the street from Ground Zero. At least our vantage point is by some of the gravestones, and it's winter, and there's this moment where we see the snow slowly overtake this gravestone as it grows, which you wouldn't think, you know, you think in some ways that would be kind of a tangent to the story, but that was a powerful moment in the film in some way, I think, because it showed that progression and how things, as you said, were moving on, I guess.
Yeah, I was very cognizant with positioning the cameras with my director of photography, Tom Lappin, of putting them in places that I felt had an emotional power. And one of the cameras was put in St. Paul's because I was in the foreground were the gravestones of people who had passed before that time.
Right.
In the background, over time, what you would see is that the site would kind of begin to emerge from the space, from the void. And I felt like the combination of those things were important. But I also felt, as you said, that the passing of seasons was important, that there's a sense of, I can't explain it, but it's almost a calm realization that we all have, that we're part of this, you know, kind of long journey where we're here. Mm. And as time passes and as seasons pass, our lives change. And that moment takes place at an important moment where Brian, who you referenced from the very beginning, was really beginning to start to realize that he was, he hadn't healed. It had been 3 years, but he was struggling with the healing and that he had kind of postponed it.
Yeah.
And now he was about to enter a phase he wasn't aware of at the time, but what we come to determine and see in the film was the kind of the depth of his post-traumatic stress, which was just oncoming at that point. And so to me, it felt important to kind of see the counter. Yet it was a counterpoint, and at the same time, it was a it was a compliment to what he was really about to go through.
And the physical transformation of Brian and all of them is subtle. It's not gimmicky. It's subtle, but it's remarkable. I mean, we see them right in front of our eyes. They begin to change. That's another really kind of extraordinary dimension of this film.
Well, I appreciate that. We were very aware right from the very beginning. What I wanted to do was really create an environment that held no distraction for an audience member. So everything is black behind the subjects and the participants in the film. And so the hope was that as they moved through time, you just were actually subtly aware that they were, in the case of Brian, as we all do, growing older. In the case of Nick, who was 16 at the time I began filming him, he was growing up.
Yeah.
You know, he was becoming a man. And Tanya, I find her transformation. Tanya lost her fiancé, and her transformation as she begins to discover the potential of love. It's interesting to me that you actually can almost see her. She a fullness kind of emerges.
That's
in her face.
The word that it's a yeah. It's, there's like and it's not that she gained weight, although that was maybe part of the process. As maybe we can talk about this as she progresses, but there's like a softening in her body. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it was almost a it really what it was is she became open. She became open to love.
Yeah,
and to dating and to beginning life. And to me, what was important, I always say to Tom, my director of photography, you know, if it feels like we're close, we could probably get a little closer. And I felt that because I just felt I wanted the audience to just be able to feel this intimacy and also to just be able to pick up on the smaller feelings of what was occurring physically.
Yeah.
Not that I felt there was any need to over-dramatize. When I've always talked about how we were going to approach the film, right from the very beginning, I always said, we're just going to put a mirror up to the site, and we're just going to put a mirror up to the people who are participating in the film and just allow it to evolve and for them to evolve in whatever way they evolve. And that will be in itself will be enough. And if we can hold to that and allow it to be what it is going to be, then I think it'll be a powerful thing to see over time.
Well, you don't label them with their names. We don't know what they do at first. We have to come to know them in a different way, which I guess that's what that's about, the way you
Yeah.
Is put as little information as possible, and we come to get to know them, I guess.
Yeah, I was very conscious of I wanted the audience to feel as close as possible, and I felt that if we in some way kind of even said, you know, with a chyron across the bottom of the screen, this is Tanya, this is Tim, and that it would give a sense to the audience that they were watching somebody else. And my goal actually was to, you know, because the film is about certainly about 9/11, but in a larger sense, it evolves, I think, into becoming kind of universally about loss and how we all go through loss and we all experience it in different ways. And so for me, I wanted audience members to be able to kind of fall into each of the particular journeys that were taking place. One might be more fitting to them, to their own experience, than another, but I wanted them to be able to kind of, you know, kind of fall into it without any sort of impediment of feeling that, that anything was stopping them from leaning forward into it. And so I did, you're right about that. I was on purpose.
Well, you mentioned that all we see is black at parts, and which brings up a question about what the film is not about. I mean, it's not about the politics of the war, the way people were treated after 9/11, or the war that came from it. I mean, the imagery that we see at first is that black. It's that darkness. No images of the towers themselves. We never see that. No billowing smoke, no running people, just black.
Yeah, I really felt we didn't need to see those images. And I guess on a level of a kind of a feeling of, again, a connection with the film for an audience, I also felt that whatever experience anybody had of that day was their own experience and it was personal to them.
Yeah.
And I wanted to create spaces in the film to allow the viewer to bring their own remembering of the day and emotion of the day in those black spaces to allow them to feel it for themselves. And also, you know, from the very beginning, the film was always about what happened afterwards. It was always about the hope, the resilience, the potential of what was going to happen in the aftermath. And so for me, it was important to identify that the day happened through the eyes of the people who experienced it in the film, but then it was just as important because of what the film was about to allow a sense that they could, that we could move on into what the film was really about, which is about the aftermath and the healing process, really, over time.
Yeah. Jim Whitaker is with us. He's the director and producer of the film Rebirth. Thursday night at 7 o'clock, KUER and the SLC Film Center is going to be offering a free screening of the film at the Salt Lake City Public Library. Jim Whitaker is going to be giving a Q&A via Skype following the film. For more information, you can visit us at KUER.org/Radio West. And we should mention it's free and open to the public, but it's first come, first serve, so you may want to get there a bit early. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our series on documentary film called Through the Lens. The director, Jim Whitaker, is our guest today. He's joining us to talk about his powerful film called Rebirth. For nearly a decade, Whitaker has been following five people whose lives were changed by the attacks on 9/11. So that film is about the passage of time, but we see extraordinary time-lapse photography, for example. But it's also about that struggle to remember and try to move on as well. We're going to be screening the film on Thursday. We'll give you more details about that. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jim Whitaker, I wanted to ask you about, it's interesting in the film how we see these moments of realization come to these people at various stages of the process. And it seems like almost always they come in the form of an image or a thing or a symbol. There's this really powerful moment where Tanya, you mention, and I don't know how much you want to say about this, but this idea of food comes at a moment of kind of realization to me. Like, it's never said exactly. There's always something – it's not just a metaphor, but there's always a symbol connected to it in some ways. Did you notice that, of course?
Yeah, it's interesting. Tanya's an interesting example as well. At a particular moment early on, as I kind of think is interesting in life, when something very powerful is happening and a change is happening or a discovery or a piece of information, in this case, the kind of her refusal to potentially know that her fiancé Sergio is not alive anymore, and receiving a phone call about some firemen that just want to bring over some food. Yeah. And, you know, it's such an elemental thing, food. You know, it says so much in that, in what it is and what it means and what it means for someone to bring it to you. And for her, it became a moment where she started to say, well, what do you mean? What do you mean you're bringing over food? So she, if a kind of perseveration she had on this idea of what are you really trying to say? Because oftentimes in those moments you're wanting to interpret, you know, the thing itself as meaning something different. And so the symbols are, I think, are important for, and that was one in particular. Another one is the young boy Nick who might not give this one away, but has a moment with a bird.
Yeah.
And
yeah, don't give that away, Jim. It's such a moment.
Yeah, it's quite a powerful moment that happens. But, you know, I think one of the things that I didn't mention is that my mother had passed away 6 months before September 11th. So I actually came into the space of the site in a kind of open place. I was very open to the notion of grief and a loss, and I was very curious about how it worked. And so in many respects, the journey of the film was one I was exploring with them as I moved along through it, kind of how it worked. And you know, I know for myself, I had this conversation, I know at one point with them that, for a period of time, if anyone kind of in a moment sort of was around me and for some reason in a kind of moment of intense realization, they were wearing red, I felt as if my mother was there. And and that wasn't wrong for me, you know. Yeah. It was the right feeling. And so we often had conversations about and those things still happen, by the way, you know.
Yeah.
We had very intimate conversations about kind of how it works and what things can happen that allow you to feel a certain comfort from the world around you when it's very difficult, especially when you're in the kind of the very difficult area of having lost someone and trying to figure out how to kind of move forward and through it, which is what really the film ends up showing is how people work their way through it. But symbols become an important part of that.
Let me play a clip from the film. This is Tim, who has lost his... He's a firefighter, who's lost his best friend. Another firefighter, of course, in 9/11. And I think, for me, it's another one of those examples of kind of indirectly connected to him, but has meaning. His friend, friend's wife, Beth, found out she was pregnant, which she says in this clip. And let me just play this clip from Jim Whittaker's film called Rebirth.
Beth found out that she was pregnant on September 13th, 2 days after my best friend Terry died, which was certainly a happy miracle. We started talking, and I realized that no one had cleaned or painted or fixed up the bedroom for the baby, for little Terry. And she told me that, you know, she had been waiting for someone to paint it and it just hadn't gotten done yet. And so I told her to give me the keys. And last week, I was honored to paint Terry's room pink pansy.
from Jim Whittaker's film, Rebirth. At what point, Jim Whittaker, did you realize that watching this film, seeing these stories, you know, seeing the footage, hearing the stories, wasn't really a passive experience for people, that people could actually, you know, use those stories, actually learn from those experiences?
Well, it happened about 3 or 4 years in. I had taken a compilation of the film and the first 3 or 4 years interviews, and I was using it to continue to raise money for the film, and I would watch audiences respond emotionally, and I felt, and they would often come up to me afterwards and say, "I'm feeling better as a result of having seen this. Somehow watching someone else go through it, it's allowing me to feel a kind of a certain catharsis, because it's giving me this sense that I'm not alone in what I've been going through, that there's other people that have." And because of the way it's coming to me, I'm feeling this sense of a catharsis. And it really made me start to think, you know, something that I felt very important that could happen was that the film could actually help people. Yeah. And that discovery led me to a series of conversations with the now chairman of the board of Project Rebirth, Brian Rafferty, to ask the question, how could we use the film to help people? And I went to Georgetown University, as did Brian, and we had dinner one night with the president of the university, and I, Jack DeJoy, and I said, he actually said, you know, he kind of prompted me and said, "Well, how's it going? And tell me more." And yeah. I said, "Well, I think we might be able to help some people with this." And he said, "Well, do me a favor, bring what you have down, bring it to the university, and let's play it for a group of academics." And so he gathered about 30 academics from different fields together, and we played the film, and he said, "You know, what do you think, anybody think they could do something with this?" And a whole bunch of hands shot up, and they began to just say, "Yeah, of course, if we could, you know, use the raw footage, and if we could use even the film itself, we could just begin to use it as a teaching tool for psychologists who are learning to, you know, to advance in their field." Right. There were various different ways, and what I didn't realize was there had never been, to my knowledge and to our understanding, a record of people going through grief on film over such a length of time. Didn't exist. And so it actually was, in itself, by being able to use it, was an opportunity to begin to allow people to use it in a way that could be used academically or be used in other sort of, by creating teaching and learning tools and other ways that we could help people. And that began a process 3 or 4 years into it of beginning to try and endeavor and figure out how to make it work and how to make the film work for other people to help them. So, yeah.
Well, others, you know, others involved in the project have talked about how not just hearing the stories, but that your interviewing techniques were important learning tools, which I wanted to ask you about. I mean, how, because in some ways you weren't just asking conventional questions, you know, or at least it seems that you were getting at, and we talked about symbols before and distilling the moment. So it seems like you were zeroing in on memories and feelings, but not in a, I don't know, how did you go about the interview, I suppose, is the question.
Well, I said to them from the very beginning that I'm not looking for a soundbite. I'm not, I'm not an anchor of a news channel or anything like that, for example. Or I'm not looking for a moment. I'm just looking to have a conversation. And I said, if I'm looking for anything, I'm looking for the moments and the thoughts that you have in the morning when you're taking a shower that are your own thoughts. And I'm looking to actually talk about those feelings. The process of doing the interviews was, it's anywhere from 3 to 5 hours at a time. Wow. And it was a conversation. And what I said to them was, I said, you know, you're going to be having a thought about something and you may think of something else. And I said, I really encourage you to just get off what I called Main Street and go down the alley. Right. And yeah. I'll follow you down the alley. And if I, for some reason, want to kind of bring you back to Main Street for whatever reason, I'll do that. But it's more important to me to allow you to just go in your own minds and hearts to the places that feel most honest and truthful to your experience. And a lot of times I felt like the opportunity, which was really an opportunity and a blessing and an honor to be able to interview these people, I felt it was very important to be very present. And a lot of times when we were talking, I would see something kind of, you know, when you're sometimes talking to someone and something passes across their eyes, like a thought.
Yeah.
I would just say, "What was that?"
Right.
And they would say, "Well, what do you mean?" And I'd say, "Well, it seems like you just had a thought about something." They said, "Oh, well, it was, you know." And then actually, a lot of times it would go to a place like, "Well, you know, it reminded me, I was walking down the street and I saw a person and they had a dog, and the dog," and we would just kind of go down that. And so what I tried to do was simply be present and listen. And to the extent that as an outside observer, I could make connections that they may not see, I was conscious of doing that in a way of also really coming from a place of curiosity. As I said, I was also from a very different place and in very much of a kind of lockstep journey of wanting to understand how it really worked. And, you know, how do people get through loss? How do they, I wouldn't say overcome their grief, because I don't think that's how it works, but how do they learn to move through a healing process of living with it and being okay with it and coming to a better place with it? And so it became a very interactive experience, which was I think powerful on both sides, you know.
Well, let me play another clip. This is from Tanya. And it's almost like she's confessing this secret that she's been carrying around. I mean, we should say that she was 34 when Sergio was killed. And she talks about, we see this progression, where she talks about how being caught in the middle. I mean, she wants to stay close to him in some ways, but she knows she has to move on. Some of her, a part of her doesn't want to. She feels this guilt about it. But then in this clip here, she talks about wanting to feel some kind of touch. You know, and to me, this moment, Jim Whittaker, is this confession, this kind of revelation. And I guess this is one of those alleys she went down. And maybe she wasn't willing to share that at first, it seems, in some ways.
Yeah, she I think didn't know how to come to grips with it. And I think she was dealing with the betrayal of it.
Right.
And then she finally said, you know, she just started to explain. So you want to play the...
Yeah, go ahead.
I even have to say that my truth, I wasn't ready to tell my truth fully. My truth is dating. It was a very, very painful decision to start dating again. You know, it's such a betrayal. It's a betrayal. How could I have feelings for wanting to just be intimate? That, just to have intimacy again. When, you know, it was like, how could you, but your body, and especially after that, I ached to be held, you know, to be touched. I ached for that.
It's from Jim Whittaker's film Rebirth. That's Tanya. Thursday night at 7:00, KUER on the SLC Film Center is offering a free screening of the film at the Salt Lake City Public Library. Jim Whittaker is going to be giving a Q&A via Skype after the film. For more information about that, visit us at KUER.org/Radio West. The event is free, and the seats are available on a first come first serve basis. So plan on arriving early. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our documentary film series. The director, Jim Whittaker, is our guest, talking about his film called Rebirth. It premiered at Sundance. We're screening it on Thursday, and we'll give you more details about that as we go along. Jim Whitaker, I wanted to ask you about the music, because it almost seems like the music is it kind of another character in some ways in the film. Philip Glass did the music. I wanted to ask you about what your conversations were with him, because it seems like, I mean, you've talked about how the music pulls together the path of the subjects, and I wanted you to talk about what you mean by that.
Well, I first of all felt, you know, incredibly fortunate to be that he would consider doing the film, and it was a great experience. And actually, he was the first person I ever showed a cut of the film to, which was an amazing experience because I just didn't know how people would react, and he very much liked it. I think what was great about the experience is when we first sat down, and it was kind of like a wonderful moment. You have a moment where you know when you try and do something, and as I was trying to create this this film and sort of have this kind of meditation of the time lapse with the people, and there was there were challenges I was dealing with. I sat down with him, and the first thing he said to me was, "I just want you to know I've started writing." And it was a very powerful moment for me, because it was kind of, it made me feel like he's in it, and he's beginning, and he's joining in and understanding what I'm trying to do. The second thing we talked about, and you know, he said, and we discussed really, was the need for the music to capture the underlying power of the subjects as they march through towards their healing to a hopeful place.
Yeah.
And he really understood that while at the beginning there was some difficulties and challenges and there was sadness because it was necessary, because there was loss, that at a certain point the subjects of the film began a process of coming through that, as you can feel Tanya in that last clip, and that the site at the same time was starting to come through and beginning to kind of emerge slowly, and started, and then it began to gain a force and a power. And he really understood that, and we talked a lot about that it needed to have this pathos of strength to it that captured not only an emotional healing, but the physical evolution of the site and what was behind that. You know, again, I talked before about people building buildings. Well, that's the physical human dimension to it. And then there's just the idea of the kind of strength of the steel and the beams and the Freedom Tower beginning to emerge, and the power of that. So he understood the path of the character that was Ground Zero and how it was working with the path of these characters as they were healing. And I think he really, in a very emotional way, which was very important to me, was that the emotional essence of the healing process was captured over time. He, in a very emotional way, also captured this sense of it's the moving forward, you know, the hopeful process of moving forward and healing. And he really, I think, did a beautiful job with that.
There's a moment in the film that I felt conflicted about in some ways. Brian, the construction worker who's lost his brother, he talks about there were moments when, you know, everything would remind him about his brother, and this emotion would come out. And he talks about this experience at Home Depot where, you know, he would just see like two brothers going into Home Depot, and he would think about his brother. And I mean, at that part of the film, he's not really started to heal, but then time progresses, and then there's this other moment, and I wanted to play it and have you talk about it when things have changed. Let me play this. This is Brian from Jim Whittaker's film Rebirth.
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm over that now. I don't know. I guess so. That's all healed up. I don't think about that stuff anymore. It's more about just the memory of everybody down there. You want to rebuild the thing to give everybody the dignity that they deserve, that would lost their lives there. You want to get the memorial done so there's a place for family members to go, and then rebuild the infrastructure so it's an acting city again. To be honest with you, a few months ago, you wake up one day and you realize, hey, my life's almost over. And, you know, what am I doing here? And, you know, where am I going with it? And, you know, I've been on one thing focused so desperately. You know, what about the rest of my life or my goals that I wanted to do? I'm just lucky that I'm grateful for what I have. You know what I mean?
It's interesting. I mean, part of me felt like, well, good for him. I mean, he's moved on and he's, you know, he's thinking about the city, and every time Dewey goes to a Home Depot, he's not going to be thinking of his brother necessarily. But then I felt kind of sad about that as well. I mean, do you think mm-hmm. there's kind of a mixed emotion in the fact that they do move on? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I do. I think I think it's, you know, one of the interesting things about Brian is he's he went through this big process of experiencing this post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
And, you know, here was a person who, when I sat down with him in the beginning of the film, was talking about having lost his brother. And I kind of was thinking, wow, I'm waiting and to kind of understand when the emotional part of that is going to connect in for you. Mm. For you. Mm. By the time he gets to the other side of it, I think he's it's a bit of a, and this is what I appreciated about his character from the beginning and who he is as a person. He works at Ground Zero. He works in construction every day. He gets up and he builds.
Yeah.
He has a very, very concrete, and in many ways, an incredibly beautiful way of approaching life. And he really worked so hard. What was astounding is he really approached his PTSD like he almost actually approached Ground Zero. We're going to build this thing. He's like, I'm going to get through this. And so him coming out the other side there in the way was almost kind of a statement of a sort of a pronouncement of his, you know, I'm all done with that. I worked on that over many years. I got through it, and I'm feeling like I'm ready to kind of, I'm now in a different phase of my life. What, if you don't mind me commenting on, I think is interesting, you know, you have to make choices. And I had a great editor, Kevin Filippini. Hmm. We spent a year and a half in an editing room, and he spent 8 years prior to that. But you have to make choices of things you keep in the film. And the comment he makes about, you know, I'm 50 and what am I doing here and what about the rest of my life? And it was interesting to me about that was that, and I hope that in a certain way by the end of the film comes through, is that life is messy.
Yeah.
You know, you make choices to do one thing and your life changes dramatically, and then you have to make choices to continue with them. Your heart and your emotion may be in it, but you have to make choices about your own life. And so actually, it captured this kind of wonderful thing that we were always trying to get at, which is that life is really complicated and it's messy and the outcomes aren't clear always. But I wanted to just have that feeling that he was sort of saying, you know, I actually have a life here too, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
I love my brother, but I have a life here too, and I gotta, you know, and I'm 50 and I have to now make a choice, which just actually has to do more with, you know, kind of the idea of time passing and how does one progress in life as we move through our lives. And so to me, it did a lot of different things, and I really fought to kind of keep it in together because it felt like it captured that that essence of that messiness in a good way.
Well, it absolutely does. And I think, you know, Tanya says, well, they all do in some ways. You know, Tanya talks about that it's time now. You know, there's a moment when she figures, okay, it's time to, you know, let go. And that's an important moment for her Nick, who goes through this, you know, I won't say too much about it, but he goes through this transition where much of his life is about his mother. And there becomes a moment where he starts to realize that it's got to be about me. I mean, you see that kind of, mm-hmm. it's almost like all of them come to that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was you know, in making the film, what was a really interesting thing was around year four and year five, almost in a kind of en masse, there was a shift that started to take place. And I really started to see that the film was going to, in many, you know, in 3 years beyond that or 4 years beyond, it was going to be announcing its own ending.
Right.
And what, through the slow progression of time, what you begin to see is how they get to a different place, and then they are able to kind of actually see where they are and actually talk about it. And I'm kind of amazed and interested in how they do that, in the sense that they have a really great way of. Nick in particular is a, you know, he's a young man. He started out at 16, and by the end of the film, he's 24 years old. And 16 was when it happened. We started interviewing when he was 17, and he has this great ability to kind of take in all of the changes that have happened, and process it in a way that I actually personally found myself in the interview going, "Wow, I'm still, you know, I'm still working through some things myself."
You mean like your mother, for example?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and here's this young man who just right before my eyes has kind of come to this great realization of where he is. What I appreciate about what you're saying and what I believe the film captures is the hopefulness that. There is another side to it. There is another side. It can be very hard, but there is another side to grief and loss that you can get to. And I think, you know, Tanya, I think, captures it quite beautifully when she, you know, says it'll always be there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean I can't have a life of joy. And so I was really interested in capturing, and capturing is the wrong word, I was kind of just documenting and seeing what was happening and where they were getting to. And it was a really amazing place of realization by the end, which was remarkable.
You know, at the very end of the film, one thing that strikes you is how many people were involved. Like the credits, there's almost a kind of emotional impact, I know, of that for you. Just how many people were a part of all of this?
Well, it's probably the most emotional part of the film for me in so many respects, because it was a 10-year process ultimately of making the film, and the credits kind of keep going and going because they include all the people who gave money. They include all of the, which started with, the Aon Foundation and Oppenheimer funds and the LMDC, and then begins to kind of go through all of the people who worked on the film. And when you're dealing with so many subjects who are moving around the country and doing so many things, and you're dealing with what ended up being 14 cameras down at Ground Zero,
wow.
all shooting 35mm film, and you're changing the film out every 3 weeks in order to have these sort of historical images captured at the highest quality, it requires a lot of people and a lot of involvement and a lot of coordination. And you know, it is quite emotional because they do kind of keep going and going, but we really wanted to account for everybody who had been involved over these many years, who had really come in and said, you know, we're gonna help sort of, you know, complete the film. And I think when I finished the film, I didn't, I don't know that I completely saw how much sacrifice was involved. You know, this sometimes you do. It's a little like Brian Lyons. You know, you're focused on something for so many years. And, you know, my wife, Chris, and we now have a daughter, Rebecca and Emmett. You know, there's a credit at the very end for them. And that's always quite emotional for me because the sacrifice was a great deal for them. But but also for so many people. Involved. My best friend, you know, one of my closest friends, Nick Wood, whose wedding I went to, you know, began the process of raising the funds and has been involved for years. And Pat Ryan and Michelle Kidley. I mean, the names go on and on and on.
Yeah.
So,
I want to ask you this finally, about a minute left. How do you figure this has changed you? I mean, I get how it's changed you as a person, how it helped you sort of heal from your moment of grief, but how has it changed you as a filmmaker, do you think?
Well, I think that I think I've learned an incredible amount, I guess is what I would say. It's impossible not to. I think one of the big things, you know, kind of has to do with trust.
Yeah.
You know, in the beginning, I didn't know where these journeys were going to go. I just set a kind of a template for where they could go. And I had this trust that grew and built over time that if I just continued to hold a mirror up to the site and hold a mirror up to the people, that over time a story would emerge that I believed would be hopeful based on my original feeling of the day of being there, but I didn't know. And I got a lot from the ideas as a filmmaker of just the feeling of just trusting, not only in what you feel, because you have a feeling of something, so it sort of urges you on to do something, but also the people you engage with, you know, the participants in the film. We chose them, you know, kind of quickly and in a way that sort of made it, they felt right and it felt right. And I feel very fortunate that through the end of it, and I'm hopeful people will feel the same way, and hopefully they'll see this and feel it, that at the end, they're the ones who are the film. I was just lucky enough to hold the mirror up and have a lot of people behind me who were helping it to happen and a lot of trust that it would go okay and that it would emerge to a good place. And I think it has. I hope people feel that it has.
It's Jim Whitaker. He's director and producer of Rebirth. Thursday night at 7 o'clock, KUER on the SLC Film Center is presenting a screening of the film at the Salt Lake City Public Library. Jim Whitaker is going to give a Q&A via Skype after the film. The event is free. Seats are available on a first-come, first-served basis, so plan on arriving earlier. Or go to our website for the details, KUER.org/Radio West. We should also say the film is opening in select cities this month and is going to air on Showtime on September 11th. Jim Whitaker joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Jim Whitaker, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Patrick Hubley and Geraldine Dreyfus, the SLC Film Center. Thanks also to Tim Slover. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.